This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first story this week represents breaking news and comes to us from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is that the surprise U.S.-China trade deal gives the global economy a reprieve. A few days ago, it would have seemed almost impossible. But on Monday, to the surprise of global investors and everyday business fearing a trade war, the U.S. and China agreed to a truce. The world's two biggest economies unwound for now most of the tariffs that they had imposed on each other since April in a tit-for-tat battle that was threatening to stoke U.S. inflation, crash China's export engine, and upend the global economy. Stock markets in the U.S. and elsewhere surged on the news. The dollar and bond yields rose, reflecting expectations of faster U.S. growth as trade tensions recede. Investors and analysts said the outcome was much better for the global economy than they had expected on Saturday, when U.S. and Chinese negotiators started 2 days of intensive talks at the Geneva residence of the Swiss ambassador to the United Nations. The U.S. agreed to lower the base level of tariffs on most Chinese goods to 30%, down from 145%, while China said that it would cut its levies on U.S. products to 10% from 125%. The 30% rate imposed by the U.S. includes a levy related to China's alleged role in the fentanyl crisis plaguing the U.S., an issue in the weekend's talks. The U.S. tariff on many Chinese products will be higher than 30%. U.S. duties on steel, aluminum, and autos remain in place, as do some earlier tariffs on certain Chinese goods imposed during President Trump's first term in office and that of former President Joe Biden. Washington and Beijing agreed to keep the new tariff levels in place for 90 days, with the goal of working toward a broader deal on trade in further talks. China said it would cancel or suspend some non-tariff trade measures it had imposed to hit back at the U.S., potentially including easing export restrictions on critical minerals used in batteries and other high-tech applications. Speaking at a news conference in Geneva, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that the U.S. was seeking a long-lasting and durable trade deal with China. He said a clear break between the two economies wasn't desirable, and neither side wanted to decouple. Bessent said the U.S. still had grave concerns about its unbalanced trading relationship with China, and he cited issues such as China's management of its currency and its subsidies for manufacturing, which Washington believes are a major factor driving factory job losses in the U.S. Those and other issues will be discussed in talks over the next 90 days, he said. The outcome forestalls for now what was shaping up to be a destructive clash between the world's two biggest economies, with potential ripple effects across the globe. Retailers in the U.S. were warning of empty shelves if they couldn't get Chinese products, and some small businesses were worried that they would go under without easy access to China's vast factory floor. Economists warned higher prices and shortages risked reigniting inflation. For China, an unrestrained trade clash with the U.S. would threaten millions of jobs tied to serving U.S. consumers and potentially worsen trade tensions with other countries wary of a surge in Chinese imports. China was also worried about losing access to some U.S. products it still needs, such as Boeing planes, aircraft parts, and certain chips. Price for goods leaving Chinese factories have been falling for more than 2 years as production outstrips demand, a deflationary trend that would only get worse if trade barriers rode further. Dan Ives, an analyst for Wedbush Securities, said the scale of the tariff reduction was a dream scenario. Trump had suggested just days ago that an 80% tariff on Chinese goods seemed right. The tariff pause offers a reprieve from what had begun to resemble a bilaterally trade embargo, said Robin Zing, chief China economist at Morgan Stanley in Hong Kong. He said a surge in trade between the U.S. and China was likely during the 90-day window as both sides rushed to take advantage of the lower tariffs, a repeat of front-loading that occurred earlier this year. Bessonnet said the two sides agreed to a framework to keep talks progressing, which he said should help avoid any future tit-for-tat escalation of the kind that followed Trump's April 2nd tariff announcement. At the time, Trump imposed an additional 34% tariff on China as part of its global tariff plan, affecting most U.S. trading partners. And the figure kept rising as Beijing and Washington traded rounds of retaliation. Though the sides didn't come to an agreement over the fentanyl tariffs, the U.S. made clear in private meetings its views on the importance of combating the deadly drug. Trump has accused China of playing a role in the illicit fentanyl trade, something that Beijing denies. In a private meeting on Saturday, Bessonnet picked up a bit of sugar out of a dish on the table and told Chinese officials that the amount he was holding could kill a person if it were fentanyl, said a person with direct knowledge of the exchange. Bessonnet picked up a little more sugar and said that that amount could kill people across Geneva. Then he picked up more and said that this much could kill people across Switzerland. In a briefing with a small group of reporters, Bessonnet said that although fentanyl wasn't the main focus of the trade talks, the Chinese delegation included China's Minister of Public Security, Wang Zihong, who was able to discuss the issue in detail with U.S. officials. Such an official isn't usually part of a trade team, Bessonnet said, and that shows their responsiveness to our concerns. Since the start of his second term, Trump has been adamant about the need to raise tariffs on China, sticking to his position even when markets were taking a hit. He said China had been ripping off the U.S. for decades and it was time to put the pressure on Beijing. But in recent weeks, Bessonnet had focused on the potential downside of an extended trade war with China. He repeatedly said that the situation with China was unsustainable. In the same social media post suggesting an 80% tariff on China, Trump also named his Treasury Secretary as the person to make the call. He said the rate was up to Scott B. Bessonnet said during the briefing that Trump was given updates after each of the 2 days of meetings in Geneva. Our next article for this episode comes from Barron's Magazine, and the title is Productivity Falls for the First Time Since 2022, What That Means for Economic Growth. The U.S. experienced its first decline in productivity in nearly 3 years during the last quarter, turning what was once a growth engine into another potential drag on U.S. economic growth. Non-farm business sector labor productivity declined at a rate of 0.8% in the first quarter, according to a preliminary estimate released Thursday by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It was the first decline in productivity since the second quarter of 2022. The first quarter slump was a deeper pullback than the 0.1% economists surveyed by FactSet expected. Growth was 1.5% in the fourth quarter of 2024 and 2.8% for the last year as a whole. The first quarter decline was driven by lower outputs and higher labor costs likely linked to the huge swing in net foreign trade, rather than sudden underlying weakness, writes Oliver Allen, senior U.S. economist for Pantheon Macroeconomics. Imports soared last quarter because businesses rushed to import goods before President Donald Trump imposed his broad tariffs. Allen believes that the first estimate of productivity growth is likely underestimating last quarter's levels. The productivity numbers are too noisy for a single quarter to tell us much, even when the underlying data are calm. But first quarter was exceptionally noisy, Allen writes. Labor productivity is the measure of how quickly and efficiently workers generate goods and services. The figures which the Bureau calculates by dividing real output by total hours worked are typically volatile. Significant revisions to the data are common. When productivity falls, businesses typically need fewer employees to produce the same amount of goods or services. Higher productivity gains can lead to stronger economic growth and help alleviate inflationary pressures. That is because rising productivity growth can put downward pressure on producers' unit labor costs, helping to boost profit margins and keep prices of goods stable. The start of the year contraction was driven in large part by factors like workers' output and hours worked not expanding as rapidly as they did in the third quarter. Output was down 0.3%, a significant slowdown from the 2.5% growth recorded in the fourth quarter of 2024. Unit labor cost also rose at an annualized rate of 5.7%. That was both higher than the consensus forecast of 4.8% and a marked acceleration from the 2.0% revision date in the fourth quarter. Swings in both output and employment as the tariff shocks work its way through the economy probably will make the productivity data harder to read over the rest of the year. But we generally expect the underlying rate of growth to slow somewhat as businesses invest has been relatively weak over the past few years. And a looser labor market eases the pressure on employers to squeeze as much out of their existing workforce. The long-term forecast for future U.S. productivity growth also is likely to look less robust than it did just a year ago. As RSM's chief economist Joe Brussolis recently wrote, protectionist policies such as those that the Trump administration has implemented tend to ultimately undermine productivity and long-term growth. That is because these policies typically result in less competition and an inefficient allocation of labor. While protectionist policies can produce short-term economic gains, more often than not, they lead to poor economic outcomes, including stagnation, stagflation, resource misallocation, and supply chain challenges. Just as the U.S. appeared to be turning the corner on productivity after a weak three-decade run, the descent into protectionism poses a threat to the primary driver of long-term growth and rising living standards, he said. Our next story comes from CBS News, and the title is Small Business Owners on a Damage from Trump's Tariffs. Beth Beneke is a mom, a veteran, and a small business owner, and she's sounding the alarm. I've been telling all my friends and family that anything you want for Christmas, to get it right now, especially if you're buying for children. If you are buying any baby products at all, get them while they're here because they're going to be gone. After a decade serving in the Army, stationed in Bosnia, Kuwait, Iraq, and beyond, Beneke started Busy Baby, a Minnesota company that designs and sells placemats and utensils for babies and toddlers. All her products are made in China, and now those products are subject to President Trump's 145% tax on Chinese imports. We have 3 months worth of products sitting at the factory, she said, and now in order to get it here, we need $230,000 on top of what we were already paid for the product, just to get it in the country. Can you afford that? Oh, God, no, she replied. So what do you do? First, I sat on my kitchen floor and cried, she said. And when I was on the floor in the kitchen, my son came in to show me something or tell me something, and he saw me sitting there crying, my 8-year-old son. And then he put his arms around me and just hugged me. And like that, I realized I'm not going to let him see this. This is not what we're going to be. The tariffs hit just after she struck a deal to sell Busy Baby products at Target and Walmart. To produce enough inventory, she took out a loan from the Small Business Administration. That loan is partially SBA financed and then partially leveraged against my house, she said. So if I can't stay in business and pay those loans, I lose the house. Inside her warehouse, this picture shows what is left, and as we're reading the article, we see a picture of warehouse shelves that are very bare. Once this inventory is sold, she said, then we're out of product. Then we're sold out. We've got nothing more coming in. One of the retailers that she supplies is Little Ruse in Kosciuszko, Minnesota. Owner Marissa Held Nordling says that she has seen shopper behavior change since tariffs were introduced. For the first time ever, she is allowing customers to stockpile baby registry gifts like her Busy Baby mats That way, family and friends can still get what they need, often for baby showers that are months away. You can't just do a registry anymore because the products aren't guaranteed and they're still going to be on the shelf. So at this point, I'm allowing people to come in, fill a bin, and they can get their exact colors, and then I close the bin and I take the product off my website. While the U.S. and China begin trade talks, economists still expect most goods to get more expensive or even go out of stock, from clothing to electronics to toys. Yale's budget lab says tariffs could add nearly $5,000 a year to families' household expenses. Kyla Scanlon, an economic analyst and author of In This Economy, How Money and Markets Really Work, said it's probably a smart time to take advantage of this weird, uncertain moment to make sure that you have what you need, just in case prices do get more expensive. If you don't need something right away, a lot of financial advisors would recommend that you do start padding your emergency fund and putting some money to the side. I ask, are these tariffs necessary to rebalance the global economy? I don't think that this was necessary, Scanlon laughed. Targeted tariffs are okay, but when you do broad blanket tariffs on everything and when the rate is confusing, when small businesses don't know how to invest, they don't know what they should be spending money on. It's just not a good economic environment. The legality of the Trump administration sidestepping Congress to implement tariffs is being challenged in the courts. President Trump says that he imposed these tariffs in part to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. When asked on NBC's Meet the Press if there were discussions about giving relief to small businesses, Trump replied, "They're not going to get it. They're going to make so much money if you build the products here." But Bernanke says that that's impossible, that manufacturing her products in the U.S. is too expensive. The cost of land is higher here, the cost of insurance, the building, electricity, employees, and these factories that are producing now in the U.S., the raw materials they're bringing in here are being tariffed as well. It's an untenable situation, even for someone as successful as Bernanke. Last week, she was recognized for her company's success while she worried about its survival. I was in D.C. to receive my Small Business Person of the Year award at the fanciest hotel in D.C. with my son in his adorable little suit and bow tie, she said, and I just sat there feeling deflated and defeated. Where would I have loved to have been celebrating that now that I have to prove it? Still, she's not giving up. She's drawing inspiration from a phrase she picked up in the military, improvise, adapt, and overcome. So Plan B is figuring out how to proceed and become a global brand and not sell in the United States, I ask. For now, it'll come back someday. You have faith? I do. I do have faith. It'll come back someday. This can't possibly last forever. Our next article can be found at The Hill, and the title is Sununu Says Trump Administration Has About 6 Weeks on China Tariff Deal to Give the Market Small Businesses Confidence. Former New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu said Sunday that the Trump administration has about 6 weeks when it comes to China to give the market and small businesses confidence. It sounds like they made some headway yesterday, but they've got about 6 weeks to really give the market and some of these small businesses confidence that it's not going to drag them down, Sununu told CNN's Dana Bush on the State of the Union of President Trump's tariffs on China. During the first few months of his second term, Trump's tariff policy has strained relationships with trading partners such as China, Canada, and the European Union, and rattled global markets. Trump's tariffs on China have also increased fears that a U.S. recession could be coming. On Friday, the president signaled he was willing to significantly bring down American tariffs on Chinese imports. In a post on his Truth Social platform, Trump said that an 80% tariff for China appeared to be the correct number, significantly lowering the import tax, currently at 145%. 80% tariff on China seems right, up to Scott B., Trump said in his Friday post, referencing Treasury Department Secretary Scott Bessent. Trump also suggested Saturday that a total reset in U.S.-China trade relations might be possible amid talks over tariffs in Switzerland between the two countries. A very good meeting today with China in Switzerland. Many things discussed and much agreed to. a total reset negotiated in a friendly but constructive manner. We want to see for the good of both China and the U.S. an opening up of China to American businesses. Great progress made, the president said in a post on his Truth Social platform. In his CNN appearance Friday, Sununu said that a recently announced trade deal between the UK and the US definitely sets the groundwork for some of the future agreements for the Trump administration on trade. The Hill has reached out to White House US Trade Representative Jameson Greer's office and the Treasury Department for further comment. Our next article comes from Inc. magazine, and the headline is "Starting from the Bottom is Actually a Small Business's Superpower." Small businesses don't face just daily challenges. They face daily opportunities as well. What do Apple, Disney, Amazon, Microsoft, Southwest Airlines, Walmart, McDonald's, Starbucks, Ford, and the Hershey have in common? They all started as small businesses. Take Apple, for instance. In 1976, Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and Ronald Wayne launched Apple from a garage in Los Altos, California. With no external funding, the team built the first Apple computer by hand. They sold early models directly to customers. It was lean, scrappy, and personal, a blueprint that reflects the spirit of small business. Maybe you're thinking your company is no Apple. However, having worked with small businesses as a coach for decades, I can tell you this. If you have a good strategy and a good managerial system, you have the ability and opportunity to grow something great. In my experience, small business, no-nonsense approach is what keeps them alive. Large companies can survive long periods of inefficiency or customer neglect, but small businesses don't have that luxury. One misstep can mean closing the doors for good. This urgency is also their superpower. Startups tend to be deeply connected to their customers. They often know them by name. They engage with employees in meaningful ways, fostering loyalty and a shared sense of purpose. Information flows freely and is accessible to everyone at every level. Everyone's on the same page because they have to be. When small businesses succeed, everybody wins, according to the U.S. Small Business Administration, because they account for about 44% of U.S. economic activity. Small businesses create two-thirds of net new jobs each year, and as small businesses grow, job security for the workforce does too. Some begin sharing profits, as Southwest Airlines famously had for decades. Small businesses push bigger players to stay sharp by offering more personalized services and lower prices. They help diversify employment opportunities across industries and regions, including rural and underserved communities. Ernst & Young found that 81% of family business owners prioritize long-term growth over short-term profits, which is certainly good for customers, employees, and stakeholders. Also, because they're rooted in local communities, they often reinvest profits nearby. In short, when startups thrive, communities thrive. Despite their critical importance, small businesses face an uphill climb. They struggle with access to capital. Traditional banks consider small businesses high-risk borrowers, especially startups without collateral or a financial track record. According to a J.P. Morgan Chase study, 50% of small businesses have a cash buffer for only 27 days or less. About one in two small businesses fail within 5 years, often due to cash flow problems. Staffing is another major hurdle. Competing with large companies to retain talent is tough. Startups usually can't match the salaries, benefits, or career advancement opportunities that big firms offer, and more than 60% of them list hiring as their top challenge. Navigating the maze of local, state, and federal regulations is time-consuming and expensive. Small businesses spend 36% more per employee on compliance than large businesses do. Whether it's labor laws, tax codes, or environmental standards, compliance pulls focus and resources away from core operations. For many small business owners, succession planning is an afterthought. Day-to-day operations consume all of their time. But without a plan, the business often doesn't survive past a single generation. So which solutions are within reach? Some challenges depend on governmental policies. States can play a role by fostering environments that allow small businesses to flourish. That means streamlining regulations, increasing access to capital, investing in infrastructure and workforce development. Some states have embraced this, and the results are clear. Regions that support small businesses see higher rates of entrepreneurship, job growth, and innovation. Other struggles can be addressed internally. For example, small businesses have a unique opportunity to engage employees as true partners in the mission. By doing so, they create a workplace culture that larger companies struggle to replicate. Employee partnership or economic engagement emphasizes shared purpose, transparency, and performance-based rewards. It turns employees into stakeholders, which increases retention and attracts the best talent. It lays the groundwork for a no-cost succession plan. Research shows that it drives profit growth, securing a better future for the people who create the company's value. This partnership approach was common practice before the Industrial Revolution, when most people worked for small farms, local shops, or family-run businesses. Back then, economic participation and ownership culture weren't corporate initiatives, but a way of life. Aligning employees' purpose with the inherent purpose of the organization, serving customers profitably, came naturally, and it worked. Given all that small businesses do for customers, employees, and communities, it's in everyone's interest to support them. Whether through policy, partnership, or patronage, everyone has a role to play. Let's continue to celebrate the scrappy, innovative, and deeply human businesses that power our economy. After all, every industry giant was once a startup, and today's small business could be tomorrow's big game changer. Continuing through today's episode, our next article comes from the Daily Mail, and the title is Trump's Small Business Czar Reveals Which Industry the President Wants to Infuse with Cash. Kelly Loeffler, President Trump's small business czar, sees a coming renaissance for American entrepreneurs, and tariffs are all part of the plan. In a sit-down interview with the Daily Mail on Friday, the cabinet member brushed off concerns over her boss's tariffs, which, according to polls, have a majority of small business owners concerned over the economy. "Look, when you hear the word tariff, think fair trade," Loeffler said with a smile while sitting in her D.C. office. "Tariffs are just one part of the fair trade policies." In fact, the Small Business Administrator shared that owners are grateful for Trump's sweeping tariffs. "I see small businesses across the country being grateful to President Trump for finally leveling the playing field." Though U.S. producers have been fearful about changing market conditions under the new economic regime, the White House is breaking down barriers so small businesses can send their items to more countries than ever before, Loeffler said. "They're about non-monetary trade barriers, and it's wonderful to see the UK trade deal yesterday that lowers some of those very high trade barriers for our U.S. farmers and our manufacturers. I think we're going to see that type of deal replicated dozens of times. That will open our ability to export," she claimed confidently. Loeffler has been given a mandate by the president to invigorate Main Street across the suburbs, towns, and cities of America. Just this last week, she went to Arizona, Idaho, and Tennessee to stout Small Business Week and tour U.S. manufacturers. "We live in a country that should be able to make its own nuts and bolts and screws and fasteners that build this country. We don't have that anymore," she lamented. "To fix that, manufacturing companies will see a massive, multi-billion-dollar, federally sponsored boost under Trump," the small business czar said. "Next generation smart manufacturing will be a major emphasis of the SBA. Investment is needed more for AI-enabled CNC machines, for example," she said. "Computer numerical control machines are the cutting-edge, often AI-enabled manufacturing instruments used for mass production." "We were impressed by how many small businesses are already employing AI to increase productivity and efficiency in their operations," she told the Daily Mail. "There's huge room to run for small business in this area, and we're going to make sure that they're at the table when we have these conversations." She pointed to the Made in America Manufacturing Initiative the SBA launched under Trump's direction in March. The program plans on cutting $100 billion in small business regulations while supporting manufacturers. Around 99% of U.S. manufacturing operations are small businesses, the administrator said, adding that she hopes to double the amount that they can receive in loans. I see tremendous optimism in entrepreneurs realizing that within change lies tremendous opportunity, and so many are already taking advantage of that, she said. Instead of worrying over increased prices, Loeffler suggested operators remain steadfast, knowing that opportunity that is coming as a result of the full White House suite of economic policies. We'll get through this period of adjustment and get all the benefit of President Trump's economic policies, including lower taxes, lower regulation, and those are huge burdens on small businesses. And then fair trade will open up many, many more opportunities, she said. The former senator explained that as the White House closes additional tariff deals, U.S. small businesses would be the first to benefit. Loeffler, 54, former Georgia senator, business executive, and WNBA team owner, credits her passion for small business to a family trucking organization they operated on her corn and soybean farm. They're truly the heartbeat of our community and too often overlooked backbone of our economy, she said. She also noted that she and Trump share a competitive streak and a mutual love of business. We're both former sports team owners and we're both competitive and we like to win, she said. Though with all the work, the cabinet member said we haven't had much time to talk about sports. Our next article for this episode comes from the Springfield News Leader. The title, Unsure About the Economy? Five Tips for Managing Uncertainty as a Small Business Owner. Economic uncertainty can be a struggle for small business owners accustomed to responding decisively to obstacles jeopardizing their future. Delayed growth and reduced hiring and innovation due to uncertainty tend to impede the performance of local businesses, whether big or small. According to the National Bureau of Economic Research, small businesses delay 4.7% of planned investments when economic policy uncertainty rises significantly, which represents approximately $40,000 to $75,000 in deferred investments per small business annually. Small businesses spend an additional 5 to 10 hours each week on contingency planning, representing approximately $5,000 to $15,000 in lost productivity, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Business bankers with experience working with small business owners and entrepreneurs understand they want concrete steps that they can take to safeguard their position and strengthen their businesses. Here are five tips that small businesses owners should consider as they navigate uncertainty. First, diversify your supply chain. Businesses that most effectively weather uncertainty usually have multiple sourcing options. If you rely heavily on imported materials, consider identifying domestic alternatives or suppliers from countries with consistently favorable terms. Even if these alternatives cost more under normal circumstances, establishing relationships with multiple suppliers creates flexibility when disruptions occur. Second, build a cash reserve. In uncertain times, aim to maintain 3 to 6 months of operating expenses in accessible reserves. This strategy will provide a buffer to help absorb sudden cost increases from suppliers, manage periods of sluggish revenue, or capitalize on opportunities if your competitors struggle. Review your business plan to identify cost-cutting opportunities that won't harm core operation and redirect those savings to your reserve fund. Next, number three, optimize cash flow. Adopt a proactive cash flow management approach by forecasting upcoming expenses, including insurance, payroll, rent, and necessary services, and estimating future revenues based on previous patterns and trends. Use an inventory management system to minimize labor and storage costs and free up cash for other needs. Automate expenses tracking for accuracy and audit expenses quarterly to identify potential improvement or saving opportunities. Implement an accounts receivable system to streamline invoicing and collections. Having a business line of credit can also be helpful when you need short-term cash flow. It provides the flexibility your business cash flow cycle needs, helping to mitigate the risk of cash flow crunch due to unexpected problems or timing issues on payables and receivables. Fourth, strengthen your new customer relationships. As a loyal customer base in a small business superpower because it provides stable revenue during turbulent periods. Invest time in understanding your customers' challenges and how your products and services solve them. Adjust your offerings to remain essential even when customers are cutting expenses, and share the rationale behind changing prices honestly and transparently to maintain their trust and loyalty. Finally, seek expert guidance. Assemble a cabinet of trusted advisors who understand your challenges and share realistic solutions. Be sure your business banker is part of your team. Not only do business bankers have a stake in your business's success, but can assist clients from across multiple sectors in identifying potential cash flow challenges before they become critical and proposing feasible outcomes and solutions. Your business banker can connect you to resources such as a revolving line of credit to cover operational cost, pay suppliers, or make strategic investments without jeopardizing cash flow. Many financial institutions also offer products and services specifically for businesses, such as our Arvest Treasury Management Service and Payment Solutions Division. They can help small businesses manage receivables and process online payments. Business bankers can also share market insight on how different industries respond to uncertainty and provide guidance on available government programs to help you prepare for your application. Uncertainty can bring both challenge and opportunity for small business. The most important thing to remember is that companies that prepare thoughtfully remain flexible enough to adapt as conditions evolve and build a strong long-term relationship with their trusted business banker, typically emerge the strongest. Our next article can be found in Fast Company magazine, and it's entitled, "What Could Be Wrong with Unlimited PTO?" Everything, experts say. How endless time off is hurting, not helping employees. Unlimited PTO policies were all the rage for a while, but now they're starting to lose their allure. Here, experts weigh in on why companies are shifting away from this once popular benefit, what alternative solutions look like, and why other options can be more effective. Unlimited paid time off policies are losing popularity because, in practice, they often fail to deliver the flexibility and wellness benefits they promise. While they sound progressive, the reality is that many employers end up taking less time off under these policies. Without a clear benchmark for what's considered normal or acceptable, employees often hesitate to use their time, fearing it might reflect poorly on their work ethic or commitment. This lack of clarity creates anxiety and inadvertently fuels a culture of overwork, exactly what unlimited PTO is meant to prevent. Another challenge is inconsistency. Some employees may feel empowered to take extended time off, while others are quietly discouraged, leading to inequities and resentment. In industries where consistent staffing is critical, the lack of structure makes planning difficult, and in some cases, managers may even override requests, further undermining the policy's intent. Additionally, unlimited PTO can't always be applied equally across salaried and hourly workers, potentially triggering claims of unfairness or noncompliance with local labor laws. As a result, many companies are shifting towards mandatory vacation policies, which would require employees to take a minimum number of days off each year. This approach removes the ambiguity, helps normalize taking time away from work, and actively combats burnout. It's especially effective in high-pressure environments where employees may otherwise push through exhaustion or skip vacations entirely. By institutionalizing rest, companies see improved retention, better morale, and a more energized workforce. It's a simple yet powerful shift, one that sends a clear message that rest isn't a perk, it's a priority. Unlimited PTO once promised freedom and flexibility, but it's increasingly clear that for many employees, especially those from underrepresented or historically excluded backgrounds, it's more of a mirage than a benefit. In my work as a senior HR leader in tech and a therapist and coach for underrepresented communities, I've seen how this policy, when poorly implemented, can erode psychological safety, blur boundaries, and increase inequity. One major issue with unlimited PTO is that it lacks structure. Without clear norms or leadership modeling, employees may feel guilty or uncertain about taking time off. Research shows that in organizations with unlimited leave policies, people often take less time off than those with set vacation days. This perceived pressure to prove one's commitment disproportionately affects women, caregivers, and marginalized employees who are already navigating imposter syndrome or subtle biases. It can make rest feel like a risk. Instead, some companies are shifting to collective rest models, structured, trust-based systems that prioritize equity and well-being. One alternative I've seen gaining traction in hybrid workspaces is company-wide reset weeks or seasonal shutdowns where the entire organization takes time off simultaneously. These initiatives remove the ambiguity and competition of unlimited PTO and foster psychological safety by normalizing rest for everyone, not just the bold or burnout resistant. This model supports all five elements of high-performing teams identified by Project Aristotle, Google's research on effective teams. One, psychological safety is boosted when everyone logs off at once, minimizing the fear of falling behind. Two, dependability grows when teams can trust that their colleagues will take breaks and return replenished, not burned out. Three, structure and clarity are enhanced when time off is explicitly defined and coordinated. Four, meaning is reinforced as employees feel that their well-being is genuinely prioritized, not just promised. And five, impact increases when people return from true rest more creative, collaborative, and focused. In today's hybrid reality, where boundaries are already blurred, the future of time off needs to be thoughtful and inclusive as our approach to work itself. Unlimited PTO may sound progressive, but the real innovation lies in creating policies that build trust, provide clarity, and prioritize collective well-being. One of the most consistent challenges I've heard over many years of practice is that PTO policies, despite their intended flexibility, often lack clear structure and guidance. This absence of clarity can lead to uncertainty around what's considered acceptable, making team members hesitant to fully utilize their time off. While teams appreciate the flexibility their companies provide, they also place high value on clarity. They want to know what success looks like and how time away aligns with performance expectations. Unlimited PTO policies in particular tend to fall short in this regard. Though well-intentioned and often introduced to help companies elevate their total rewards, they can leave people wondering how much time is too much, which leads to underutilization and inconsistent experiences across teams. What's especially challenging and somewhat counterintuitive is that this happens despite our clear understanding that time off is critical to our team members' ability to do their best work. We know it supports mental health, overall wellness, creativity, and long-term performance, yet without the right structure, even the most flexible policies can miss the mark. In response, I've often implemented an approach called life leave that complements the traditional PTO policies, for example, vacation. This framework offers flexibility with intention and empowers team members to take time off in ways that are personally meaningful to them, whether for rest, volunteering, professional development, cultural observances, or family responsibilities. What makes life leave most effective is its balance, as it supports individual needs while reinforcing clear expectations around performance and accountability. I found it particularly impactful to provide explicit guidance on how much time is available, which helps create clarity, confidence for team members, leading to more usage and engagement. At the same time, it remains flexible enough to allow people to lean in when it makes sense for them, and it revolves around the team's needs evolving as well. Unlimited PTO sounds like a great benefit on paper, but after working with several companies who were considering unlimited PTO, I have firsthand seen why this policy does not usually work well in practice. There are several reasons, but by far I believe that the biggest reason for moving away from the policy is people's behavior. That is, people are wired to want to know our score by reacting to scarcity. For instance, when we see how many lives we have left on a video game or how long a training program video runs or how many more points until we earn that free taco, we tend to be more motivated to keep going, earn more, and utilize what we have earned. Marketing professionals know this and utilize it with limited edition runs of products to create demand. Unlimited PTO removes this limited education mindset by removing the scoreboard. When people are unaware of how many days they have taken off or how many they are remaining, psychologically it makes them use less overall. Virtually every company I have experience with that has moved to unlimited time off has seen a drop off in the actual time taken. So if the purpose is less time, then it's working. But if the purpose is increased well-being and increased engagement, it's not working at all. The better solution when you have people asking for either unlimited or simply more time is to simply give more time. Yes, there's a balance sheet cost, but in reality, it's very small cost compared to other benefits with a very high upside. Creative approaches like additional recognized company holidays, floating holidays so people can celebrate religious or family occasions that aren't otherwise recognized, giving an extra day off in the month of your birthday or your company anniversary and giving an extra week or two as an earned sabbatical every few years, all go far in employee appreciation without adding a large cost burden. Additionally, leading by example helps. People pay attention to what their leaders do. So when they see leaders not taking off their allotted time, they will do the same. Conversely, leaders I work with who use their time off have employees who do so as well and are healthier and more engaged as a result. Data suggests that the popularity of these plans may be waning. Why? Job postings offering unlimited paid time off have decreased by 50% from 2022 until today, according to Revelio Labs. From 3.1 per 1,000 to 1.5 per 1,000, employee perception is also waning. Companies offering unlimited paid PTO were rated 3.2 per 4% lower in work-life balance compared to those with traditional PTO policies. While unlimited PTO sounds like the ultimate perk, our research revealed that when deciding whether to adopt this type of plan, employees generally take less time off than those with a traditional PTO plan. Research suggests that these policies are underutilized due to the ambiguity surrounding acceptable usage and concerns about appearing less dedicated. We have instituted a use-it-or-lose-it PTO policy to encourage our team members to take their full time off to recharge and rejuvenate. Also, we award a paid week sabbatical every 5 years of service. As companies rethink traditional time-off models, flexible PTO and mandatory minimum PTO policies are emerging as more innovative alternatives to unlimited leave. Flexible PTO offers freedom with a light structure appealing to organizations that trust employees to manage their well-being. Meanwhile, mandatory minimum PTO ensures employees take the time off they need to reset, which protects against burnout and boosts long-term productivity. Increasingly, companies are realizing that spending time away from work is not enough to recharge their team. They have to design for it. Structured time-off policies backed by leadership modeling and clear expectations are proving far more effective than the you-figure-it-out approach to early unlimited PTO experiments. Unlimited PTO policies are losing popularity with both employees and employers. This is largely because the logic of such policies is faulty. For such policies to make sense, extremely accurate KPIs are required, both leading and lagging, to assess all aspects of the employee's job. In theory, any employee who isn't performing at or above 100% of all job responsibilities with no risk of performance slipping should be supported in taking as much time off as they desire in exchange for continued performance. Unfortunately, it's nearly impossible to identify highly accurate lagging and leading KPIs for every aspect or responsibility of any given job or employee. Moreover, it's often difficult to track and report on all KPIs in a timely manner. Thus, employers and employees alike cannot be sure performance is truly where it should be in support of such policies. Consequently, unlimited PTO policies have often caused conflict which nobody likes. One alternative many companies are having success with is a fresh take on an old idea, flexible scheduling and flexible work. These policies often take the opposite approach, stating that the job performance goals, regardless of when or where the work is performed to achieve them or how long it takes. These programs often do not distinguish between working versus non-working hours or days of the week or any amount of hours requested, just satisfactory completion of the requirement. So it's just a different perspective to accomplish the same objective. Sometimes a different perspective can change everything. Unlimited PTO policies are fading because companies realize that offering unlimited time off doesn't translate into employees taking enough breaks, especially high performance focused on hitting deadlines. Instead of preventing burnout with a better work-life balance, getting rid of vacation minimums might lead to your best people leaving because they're exhausted and feel too much pressure to take ample time. For us, it's been much better to intentionally schedule downtime that fits in the company's work rhythm. You have to actively plan for it by finding those natural lulls between projects or busy seasons and leaning into them. If you can't manage full shutdowns, you can stagger these lighter periods across different departments so the business keeps running smoothly. Marketing teams can take a breather while engineering ramps up or vice versa. For example, unlike unlimited PTO, which puts the onus on employees who often feel that they can't step away from the work, scheduled downtime makes taking a break a normal and expected part of the job. It takes real effort to implement properly, and you need buy-in from every manager to actively champion and protect this downtime for their teams. We try to put this into practice by encouraging our team leads to actively schedule cool-down periods for their teams right after major projects wrap up or a particularly intense sprint. After our big Q1 product launch last year, the core product and an engineering folks got a designated week immediately after with lighter workload. Very few meetings and real encouragement to disconnect as much as possible before we started driving into Q2 planning. Many of our teammates tend to use vacation time when they're ready for a break and work won't pile up while they're away. We've noticed less burnout reported after those crunch times, and people generally come back feeling more focused and recharged from when they took time off. Planned PTO cycles improve operational clarity. It reduces operational clarity to some degree, at least. When time off isn't formally accrued or budgeted, teams struggle with planning. They can't accurately forecast bandwidth, coordinate coverage, or identify burnout risk if everyone is on an undefined schedule. Managers end up tracking PTO informally anyway, which then defeats the whole premise. Planned PTO cycles may hold the answer here. Instead of waiting for people to request time off, companies can pre-schedule rest into the calendar. This could involve two company-wide breaks a year, plus a set number of flexible days. The approach works better because it removes the psychological barrier of asking and builds rest into the rhythm of the business. Teams recover together. No one returns to an overwhelming backlog, and clients learn to expect and respect the calendar. Finally, transparent time-off calendars enhance team planning. There is a reason why unlimited PTO policies aren't as popular as they used to be. At first glance, they sound incredibly empowering. Take all the time you need. But the reality often plays out very differently. What ends up happening is the lack of time-off visibility across the team. When everyone's PTO is open-ended but not clearly communicated or tracked, people get caught off guard by surprise absences, especially during critical project phases. It's not about if someone takes time off, but when and how it affects the team. That's where things start to fall apart. What worked much better for us was moving to a transparent time-off calendars that sync directly with our project management tools. Everyone can see who's off and when, which helps with coverage and planning. But really made the difference were the soft limits we introduced, like encouraging team members not to book extended time off during peak quarters or financial sprint weeks unless discussed in advance. These aren't hard rules, but they give the team a structure to work with. It reduces friction and prevents the kind of calendar chaos that was quietly undermining productivity under the old unlimited PTO model. In the end, it's not about offering endless days off. It's about building a culture where taking time off is respected, communicated clearly, and planned thoughtfully so that no one feels like they're carrying the weight when others are away. Our final article for this week's episode comes from Money Week, and it's called Cash In on Your Attic. Items you may have dismissed as junk could prove surprisingly lucrative. You don't need to own a Michelangelo or a centuries-old antique to make money from an auction. There could be thousands of pounds sitting in your attic in the form of rare and collectible old books, art, or furniture. In February, for example, a first edition copy of the first Harry Potter book sold at auction for more than £21,000 after it was discovered among a deceased man's belongings set to be thrown away. Auction houses are also increasingly selling everyday items such as records, stamps, and watches. Buyers often take part online these days so sellers can reach an audience far beyond the room. In terms of gauging value, the first step to selling your old valuables is to make sure that what you have is actually valuable. Max Hassler, book specialist at Forum Auctions, which specializes in antiquarian books and manuscripts, says the two key points that sellers should assess are desirability and condition. A book, for instance, may be rare, but if the author or subject is not of interest to collectors, then ultimately the rarity conveys little weight. This logic extends to many items that you may want to take to auction. Vinyl records, for example, can command up to £10,000. Consider the White Album by the Beatles. Original copies of this seminal album by the Fab Four have traditionally fetched up to £10,000, especially those in top condition with low serial numbers and the original Apple logo. A copy once owned by John Lennon sold at auction for £128,000. A psychedelic progressive rock band called Complex, released in 1971 by the band of the same name, can also go up to £10,000. Meanwhile, according to Wessex Auction Rooms, there's been an increase in demand for records from the 1990s. Once you have determined if your items are worth selling, you can book an inspection with an auction house where an expert can authenticate your item and then guide you through your options. Valuations tend to be free, but it's always best to check that this is the case for an auction house that you select. Always pick an auction house that specializes in the type of item you're trying to sell and ensure it has a good reputation. Check whether the auction house has sold before and examine the quality of their listings. As far as costs are concerned, auction houses typically charge fees between 15 and 20% of the sales price, and there may be further expenses on top. Compare fees to make sure you're getting a good deal and maximizing your profit. You will have to agree to the auction house's terms and conditions and set a reserve price for the minimum you are willing to accept.